Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and we're transmitting across the internet. This is episode 87, Larry, 87 of Registry Matters. How are you tonight?
Great. Now, are you sure it's not 88?
I'm almost positive. I'm pretty sure I made an 87. And, you know, we recorded 86. 86 is on the website, not 87. Just, I don't know. I'm thinking that's what it is.
So you're assuming that your partner actually looks at what goes out after we record these?
I probably assume something along those lines. I mean, you do get a notification on YouTube that it comes out, right?
I do. I play the first few seconds so on YouTube to see how it sounds. And then I say, gee, I sound awful. And I hit stop. And I don't listen to it unless someone tells me I said something that I don't recall saying.
Because someone said that they couldn't hear the news ticker thing in the background. So, like, hey, it's at 20 minutes. And you go, yeah, that's there. You're just deaf.
We do have some people that are hearing challenged. But you know, that happens to our bodies as they break down.
How is it when you are 200 and whatever you are years old? How much does it break down?
Oh, it really breaks down when you're this old, I can tell you.
Your skin's almost translucent, isn't it?
It is almost translucent, and I can barely lay in the bed for more than a couple hours, even on memory foam, without it hurting.
So you need to get suspended. Do you remember the movie way back, Altered States?
I do not.
This is 70s, so I mean, you probably were seeing movies in the 70s. Anyway, so this guy, he wants to get into a quote unquote altered state. So he goes into a sensory deprivation tank, and you know, completely closed in. He's in a 98.6 degree water. So like he can't feel anything and he turns into like an ape or something like that. But anyway, you're buoyant. You just sort of hover and you can't hear anything. You can't see anything and you can't feel anything because you're just in water that's basically the same temperature. Anyway, so you should try that. Maybe you could sleep in that.
Well, I was wondering if those hammocks like on Gilligan's Island, if they would be comfortable.
I don't think that would be comfortable at all. I'm really almost positive that would be comfortable. Maybe you could get it to rock like a boat.
How did they just happen to have those things with them on a three-hour tour is what I've always wondered, all the stuff that they had with them.
Yes, a three-hour tour, you would not be stocked up and all that stuff like they were, for sure. All right, so now that we are done talking about the history of Gilligan's Island and 70s movies, I apologize because with having guests on and like 7,000 articles, I've totally forgotten to announce patrons, and I totally want to make sure that we recognize and thank the new patrons that we've gotten recently. Larry, why don't you start us off?
Well, we just got such generosity from Veronica. I don't know what to say. I just hope we can live up to provide you value for your support. So thank you, Veronica.
Thank you, Veronica. Jeff bumped up his contribution. Thank you very much, Jeff.
And Charles has joined the FYP team. Thank you, Charles.
Awesome. And then we also have George with a J. You are amazing. Thank you so very much. And thank you to all of our patrons. And thank you to all of our listeners, too. Patrons, they extend that extra little helping hand to make this whole thing worthwhile for us.
And that just might be Jorge, too.
It could be Jorge. I don't know. So, maybe
if he were in this part of the country, it would probably be Jorge.
And possibly be getting deported?
We don't deport people here.
Oh, okay.
So we're sanctuary state.
Oh, you're one of those places. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give us an update on the Georgia challenge?
Well, that would be the Halloween, the erection of Halloween signs in two counties in particular, in Butts and Spalding, which are South Metro Atlantic counties. We've been planning this since last Halloween. We've been wanting to initiate an action to prevent sheriffs from imposing their own requirements. Now, people need to distinguish between why did Narsil jump on this one? Because, well, Larry, don't you understand there's Halloween restrictions in a whole bunch of states? You are correct. But they actually are on the statute books, either in local statutes or local ordinances, or they're in the state statutes. This is a case where two sheriffs decided that they were going to impose something that doesn't exist and require people to do something. it's one thing if the statute is unconstitutional. It's another thing if a law enforcement official invents something. We think that the standard for proving this case is a little easier because they have nothing to cite to. So we have been working on putting together a legal team, and we've sent out about 258 letters just in the last 10 days to people who live in those counties that are registered. And there's been a significant response. In fact, the attorneys said that they were overwhelmed. And I don't know what overwhelmed. They didn't put a call volume, but they said they were overwhelmed with response. And I said, well, I would have been surprised if you'd have gotten more than three or four. So it could be that the effect of those signs was more than what we were able to understand looking at from the outside and not having anybody connected with us that live in either one of those two counties where the signs were required.
So just to back up there, though, you told me earlier, you said, hey, we could talk about this and the overwhelming response. I thought you were like bullshitting. I thought you were, you know, trying to be funny about an overwhelming response, but there has been something of a significant response.
They said that they were overwhelmed. And like I said, I don't know how to define overwhelmed. If you've got a busy law practice, an extra three calls may be overwhelming if you've got deadlines to meet. But it was described as being overwhelming, and that they would report
to us
in the coming days of what they were able to filter and decipher from the people who called in. Because what
and
we
was
did
it just
we
the one county
a phone call?
Okay,
we sent and out was to Butts and Spalding.
300 and change or what?
200, around 258.
Okay, cool, awesome. And so, I think those hit the mailboxes probably somewhere on Friday or Saturday of last week.
Yes, they would have been.
Okay.
They would have started being delivered a week ago on Friday and Saturday. So they're out there for about a week now.
And you're adamant that someone is going to take that letter down to the sheriff and go, man, look at these so and so's trying to stir up crap and go down the sheriff. Do you know who these people are?
I have no doubt that everything that we distribute makes its way to law enforcement, because if you've ever served any prison time, you will be quite well aware of what a snitch is. And there are people who constantly try to seek curry favor with the man. And so people who are on the registry who are wanting to curry favor, someone or some group of people will run them down to the registry office. And their justification will be, well, I'm just wondering if this is a hoax. I got these. I thought y'all ought to know that. Have y'all ever heard of this lawyer here? Have y'all ever heard of anything like this? And that will be what they will say when they take the letter in. But they are actually trying to curry favor so that that whatever slippage they might have in terms of compliance, that they're on clearly on the sheriff's team, and the sheriff will cut them a little slack, or so they hope.
These aren't just people simply on the registry. These are people that are also under supervision, right?
No, we have no way of knowing whether they're on supervision.
Okay.
Or not. We send them to everybody who's on the registry.
All right, so that probably would include then at least someone. I mean, there's a friend of mine up that way, so yeah.
I'm certain that, but the attorneys are thinking more that the people under supervision don't have as strong of a challenge.
Right.
I don't see that quite the same way the attorneys do, because compel speech is compel speech regardless of whether it's under supervision. And I don't know that without any due process, an individual tailoring, you can compel people to speak a message. The sheriff, first of all, is not their supervising entity. The sheriff is merely the registrar.
So yeah, he's just dealing with the regulation side of it, right? The living restrictions, the 1,000-foot restriction. He's just dealing with that part.
The civil regulatory scheme that's called sex offender registration. So for the sheriff to be able to say, well, they're under supervision, they get a lesser level of privacy expectation, that's not for the sheriff to decide. So I don't know that I agree. That's the beautiful thing about the law. People, legal minds can disagree. I think that the challenge is fairly strong, even if they are on supervision. If that requirement was being imposed by their supervision agency rather than the sheriff, I think then you would have to name the supervision agency as a defendant, and then the defendant would have to clarify what their tailoring was and how they identified who needed those signs, because merely being on the registry would not necessarily in and of itself pose a threat to a child trick-or-treating. So, for example, if the supervising authorities did something that they never can do competently, if they were to narrowly tailor, and please, I'm not recommending this, but if they were to narrowly tailor and say that anyone who has been convicted of this particular offense in the last 5 years that involves a minor they will not be allowed to hand out candy. They could probably get away with it, but it's not them doing it. So in my opinion, I believe that their challenge would be equally strong, whether they're under supervision or not. But since I'm not licensed to practice law, we have to do some deference to the people who are professionals and practicing law. They see it differently.
But, you know, just to back up on to like narrowly tailoring, if someone did commit their crime on like a Halloween kind of situation, that would be, hey, well, that's related. So, yeah, we're going to restrict you from the Halloween activities. But they, you know, it's not just that you can't hand out candy. You have to be in by 5 p.m. You have to, you know, you can't turn on your lights. You can't have any decorations. You can't have anything inside your house. You can't have a candy in a bowl in your house on that night.
And there again, I believe those broad brush imposition by supervising authorities would be vulnerable to a challenge. But that's not what the sheriff required, as far as we know. The sheriff required that these signs be erected.
Right.
As far as I know, the sheriff didn't impose any additional requirements. That'll come out in the vetting of the people as they call in. It could turn out that the sheriff told them, in addition to not being able to hand out candy, that there was a whole bunch of additional requirements. So we just don't know what all was imposed. We don't have enough people communicating with us that live in those counties. In fact, I don't think we have anybody communicating with us that live in those counties, do we?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Where do you think this goes? Put on your time traveling hat. Does this make it into court? Does this make it, and does a judge rule in our favor? Do they then appeal and it goes to the Georgia Supreme Court, et cetera?
Well, we're going to be in federal court, so it won't go to Georgia Supreme Court.
Okay, okay.
We're raising a federal constitutional claim.
Oh.
So it'll be in the United States District Court for either the Northern District or the Middle District of Georgia, depending on which of those two counties, because one's in the Northern, one's in the Middle District. But where I see it going is that we'll ask for an injunction, for a temporary restraining order. It's going to be tough to meet the standard because we have to show irreparable harm, depending on what happened last Halloween. For all we know, someone had projectiles launched through their windows. We just don't know what happened as a result of that. But if we cannot meet the irreparable harm standard, then the case will have to proceed to trial, unlike what happened in Tennessee, where that they were able to show the irreparable harm immediately. We have to show the irreparable harm, and it can't be speculative, and we have to show that we're likely to succeed on the merits. Both of those standards have to be met, along with some lesser standards in getting a temporary restraining order and injunctive relief. Because when you get that type of relief, you're getting relief before you've won your case. And people don't understand, well, why is it such a high hurdle? Because you haven't won your case. You're getting relief before you have proved your case by the standard of evidence. So it has to be a high standard.
So this is like before due process kind of sorta?
Yes, when you get an injunction, you're getting the court to award you relief before you've won that relief.
Right.
And so they have a very high standard to beat to get that relief.
Okay, and that would tell you, that would give you some sort of looking glass forward to say, if they do grant that, that weighs to some degree of like an opinion saying, well, that's good news. I mean, if they say no, then it looks less favorable that there would be a win.
That's a good way to phrase it. If you're able to meet the very high standard for injunctive relief, you have already had the court telegraph to you that the authorities that you cited are sufficient for the court to believe that you're likely to win after the trial has concluded down the road. And you've shown the court and you've convinced the court that the harm that you say will actually flow without the relief. And it can't be speculative. And people, you can imagine all sorts of harm, but that's not sufficient for injunctive relief. That's the problem that we had with international Megan's Law. And people,
right, I was just going to ask.
That listen regularly, because everything that people tried to imagine was speculative. We did not know, since we didn't know what the marker was going to look like, we did not know what the consequences of the marking would be. And that was so difficult to understand, except it wasn't difficult at all to understand because it was all speculation. If you understand the basic concept that the harm has to be certain and not speculative, you would have known that without knowing what the marker is, you can only speculate about what the harm would be. That's all you could do. It means you lose on your injunctive relief. It doesn't mean you lose on the merits, but it means you lose on your injunctive relief.
And just as a comparison, I haven't seen what the Oklahoma or the Alabama markings are, but someone showed me their Florida driver's license, and it just had this tiny little a little code at the bottom. It was really benign, and if you didn't know to go look for it, it would not jump out at you. But I believe that the Oklahoma and the Alabama ones, like, you know, it's like a do not cross kind of sign, like a red circle with a line through it, but says, you know, offender on it.
Well,
there's no misinterpreting that.
Well, the Oklahoma was upheld. The Alabama was struck down. So the Alabama redesigned their driver's license, and the Oklahoma, unfortunately, did not fare as well. And you got two different circuits. You got the Alabama being in the 11th Circuit, and I think that was a district court decision. And I maybe need one of the listeners to correct me. I don't know that Alabama appealed that, but if they did, it would have gone to the 11th Circuit, and then Oklahoma's in the 10th Circuit, so it would have gone to a different court. And the decisions are not binding on one another. They're persuasive, but not binding. Right. So you can have splits within the circuit, which is a good thing, because it would argue for getting this issue of marking licenses and important documents to where the limits are. There would be limits on what you can do on a governmental document. But just to say that you can't mark, it's absurd to say you can't mark a document. We mark all kinds of documents all the time. Yeah. That's what the governments do with their documents. We mark driver's licenses in most states. If you're under 21 or under 18, but certainly under the drinking age, they make you have a vertical license in my state. That's marking. Clearly, that's marking. If you're under sanction for DWI and you have an interlock license, they mark that. Of course, you can mark documents.
Well, and the reason why I bring that up, though, is because, you know, without knowing what was going to, and not that this is the IML show rehashed, but I'm just saying, you know, no one knew whether it was going to be some big, like, whole page by itself that says offender, or is it going to be like a tiny little dot in the corner of a page that, like, only the people that know to look for it.
And that is why it was speculative and premature.
Right. That is what I was trying to get at. Were you ready to jump down some articles, or was there anything else you wanted to hit about the Georgia thing?
Oh, well, let's do it. I think that's enough information about Georgia. I'm hoping that we can get one of the legal beagles from Georgia to come onto the podcast. They've been on the NARSL in action, but we haven't had Mr. Yurchek or Mr. Begnaud on this podcast. So perhaps we can after they get through with their screening and they have something to report.
That would be pretty awesome. Yeah, that'd be great. All right. Well, the first one comes from the Colorado Sun, and you know, and the way that this article is focused is on about people that are on the registry, but this really feels more like it's almost anybody that is convicted of a crime. But it says state and local laws push more registered sex offenders into low-income Colorado communities. I'm pretty sure, short of the restriction part of it, where your more affluent communities can kind of band together, and they could pop up a daycare or a park. Not necessarily at will, but they could make it so that you keep making these different areas that our people can't live in. But I, you know, convicted felons, formerly incarcerated folks, they don't end up to rise often. They don't end up rising to the top of the food chain, so to speak. But they end up in poor hotels, and you know, then maybe that hotel has somebody complain, and then they have to move to another one. And they talk about how it just, you eventually end up homeless. And for what cost? That it doesn't improve anybody's safety, which, you know, we can fire back around that one again if you want to.
Well, it's one of those things where it's a combination of factors. Economics largely drive that that bus. If you have just total equal restrictions, which we don't support any restrictions on where people can live, but if you have equal restrictions, economics drives the train more than anything else, because 87108 would be one of our zip codes. It would be an example. That used to be known as the war zone. The people living that zip code don't prefer that title, so they prefer it has evolved now to be known as the international district. But it's still a very economically challenged part of our city, which means that landlords can't be as picky. The properties are older. The desirability of living in that neighborhood is less than the more modern, more affluent places. So the if you have rental properties, you're more likely to be a little more tolerant. So you find out that this complex takes people on the registry, and first thing you know, you've got several in that complex because it's so difficult to secure housing, and that's more of what's driving the bus is economics. You go where you can afford to go, and people on the registry are very, very underemployed and underutilized in terms of their talent. And I'm not saying they're all holding tin cups under a bridge. That is not true. But there are a lot of people in the registry who are employed at far less than what their education and their skills would permit, because merely being on the registry deters so many employers from hiring them, and particularly the employers that have to, employers who have to be listed on the website.
Right.
Because it's subject
to and also from the employee side, you don't want to go through the scrutiny too. So you, once you find a job, you may settle.
Absolutely. You're happy that you've got something coming in, and people are complacent in terms of going out looking for work. Well, I've got a job. I'm at least able to pay my rent, and I'm stable. And but the economics are the driver of this, I think.
So I often mention Mike Superpatron a lot, and I talk to him on a very regular basis, and he is adamant that like the 900,000, whatever number you want to throw out there, 800,000, 700,000 of us that are on the registry, then, you know, one degree of separation out, families, friends, whatever, that we don't have the people listening to this podcast. But this is the single most impactful thing in your life that we should be more proactive. And what I'm trying to get at here is we don't do anything. We don't collectively. There's 1,000, there's 2,000 of us that are active. But if we were more in numbers, we could possibly affect change. And here, this is the place where you're going to get the ideas, the philosophies, the talking points on how to talk to your legislators and get these things possibly changed. Instead of keeping your head down below the firing line and saying, well, maybe it'll get better if I don't do anything. Nope, that's not going to happen.
There you go again.
Sorry.
You're doom and gloom. Yeah.
It's no, not, I'm not. I'm trying to be inspiring and all that. It's like why don't like?
When people take that attitude, I understand. Self-preservation is a powerful instinct. If you can hunker down and ride it out, I can understand that. But I ask people, how has that worked for you? Why don't you let me give you a list and provide you a list of how many times your registry has been amended in your state? And in most states, it's practically every time the legislature is in session.
You guys, and did it get better?
You just had more restrictions added to you in Arkansas. And I'm not saying that Arkansas is not doing anything. They're doing the best they can with the resources that they have available to them. But sitting back and being instinctive and flying under the radar, by and large, hasn't worked very well for those who've done that. So if you can't do anything else, and I know this gets me criticism, if you can't do anything else, give money to those who are doing something to help them defray the cost. And maybe they can pay for more things that we'd like to do. We just hired a staff attorney. We talked about it last week, had her on the podcast. That model hopefully is one that'll spread. But in order for that to be a successful model, we're going to have people really amp up their giving so that we can keep her on our staff. And so hiding under the rocks from New Mexicans is not going to be a model, because we will run out of money without support. So if you can't do anything else, go to your state, find out where you have a state organized group or an informal group or whatever, and support them in whatever way you can, because hoping it gets better doesn't make it better.
Another point in the article is fear and declining property values. There was a study done in North Carolina that estimated that if an offender lives within about a tenth to about a third of a mile away, that your home will decrease in value by about $5,500. That's awesome. So here's a business model for you, Larry. Find some offenders, get them to go move into XYZ neighborhood, you know, where they can pull it off. Property values go down, buy those houses, and then the offenders move out. And then you can turn a profit on that house.
That's entrepreneurship there.
Now, before all of you Trump supporters throw hatchets at me, this article talks about that the Mueller report, the testimony that Mueller gave to Congress a couple weeks ago. And we kind of, I don't think there's really very many people in the middle, Larry, but there are either people that said this is a scam, and there are people that are saying impeach. And that's the point of the article, is that walking in the door, the opinion has already been identified, like your opinion's already set, and nothing you say or do is going to change my opinion about what is coming down the pike. And they then turn that over to people going into the courtroom. And you're way more qualified to talk about this than I am. But I just know about people and their unconscious bias, and they already have determined ideas. As soon as they see like the headline of the article, they've already made a determination about it.
It is certainly a very significant problem with high profile cases. And then this digs a little deeper into those who are in politics, where how there's all the, your mind is made up based on party affiliation, and it's a tragedy, because other countries have recognized the power of, when you look at the founding fathers, they weren't thinking about the internet, they weren't thinking about broadcast networks, and they weren't thinking about all the things that would render a fair and impartial jury. They had no way to imagine all of that. When you're looking in the 1700s, all these things that make it impossible for someone to get a fair trial couldn't have been foreseen. So it makes it difficult. We have not evolved as far as other countries have, that won't allow you to show people's face, you know, that they won't allow you to do the perp walk. I think you've even talked about that on a previous podcast.
I do. I remember. I can't think of the guy's name. The French prime minister, and they wouldn't do a perp walk. I can't think of the guy's name, but he got accused of doing something naughty with a hotel person in New York, I believe. This is 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I can't think of that. It's like on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, but they do not do perp walks to give that perception, because you see a guy walking with the handcuffs, cops all around him, you're like, well, shit, he must be guilty.
Well, and not only that, he must be a really bad, dangerous person.
Right.
When the cops do that overreaction to how they take someone into custody and how they do their takedowns, especially like to catch a predator, when they have these 60 and 70 year old men where they tackle them, it's like, and then they have guns pointed at them. You know, when they go out to do a search warrant, they make it so everyone believes that they've got a monster. But the founders could not have ever perceived that. We were living in a relatively agricultural society by and large, except for a few cities that did exist. And the only publicity you would have gotten would have been in a newspaper. And there wouldn't have been a perp walk because nobody would have seen it. And you know, all those kind of things have evolved as society has matured and as we've advanced. And we have not built any protections in to our system for what cops are allowed to do and prosecutors are allowed to do. And therefore, unless we restrict their ability to do these things, they're not going to self-police. I think we've talked about that, about the pregnant women and about handcuffing 7-year-old. I mean, they're not going to stop doing it until they're stopped.
There's a paragraph that says, jurors are supposed to be objective and ideologically neutral when it comes to reaching a verdict. I'm at least aware that I have them, because like I kind of study this sort of as a hobby, but there's no way to get rid of them. We are inclined to favor those that are like our tribe, people that are same gender, same, you know, same sort of community, you know, same color, same race, same nationality, same religion, people that work in my workplace, all those things, like they tie into your different biases, which is the exact same thing as saying, hey, I root for this team. If you don't root for my team, then you're my enemy, and therefore we have to go to war.
Drop down the next one, the paragraph that says, when the defendant in the court of public opinion is a political figure, there's an almost unfathomable amount of biases that will bring to the table. Their party membership, their political history, and their past behavior will all inform our initial disposition to them even before the case is tried.
It's almost as if bringing someone to trial, they should be in a box and you should never see them, and you should do it entirely on paper. Almost.
Almost that. And then some people have recommended professional jurors.
Yes, I've heard about that.
They would not have these biases because they would understand. It's kind of like the theory we have about judges, that when you say something that's not admissible, I move to strike. Well, you're ordered to disregard that. Well, you don't have to, in a bench trial, you don't have to make that motion, because the judge knows what to strike and what to disregard, because they're a professional. Well, that's the theory about professional jurors, is that the professional jurors would come in without all these biases, and they would be looking for actually the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. with all the preconceived notions, and they would not make all these inferences into the shackles and the chains and the stuff that may have been published in the local newspapers or in the local print media, not print media, but the broadcast digital media. Sure. All this stuff would not have inflamed their passions. They're looking, did this person abduct the child? Did they do this? And has the state shown it beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, that would require a major change in how we do criminal justice, because it's supposed to be a jury of your peers from your community.
Do you have an opinion on that subject? I've heard that floated before, and I can see the merits of it. I was just like, what is your opinion? Are there merits that make it even like worth the conversation?
I think there are merits to make it worth the conversation. I think that how fair of your trial you get around this country for the few cases that go to trial is very dependent on the type of juror that you have, and you take the educational level and the sophistication of a particular a jury pool, which is what you're going to get. If you're in a place where there's not a lot of educated folks, you're not going to get a lot of educated jurors. Sometimes educated jurors are needed because of the complexity of the issues that we're looking at. When you talk about tech, do you realize how bizarre I look at you when you start talking about, I would not be able to sit on a jury that understood it. They would remotely understand the issues. So the sophistication of jurors has a lot to do with how fair the trial is. A lot of them look at it and say, well,
is that something that has come of age?
What's that?
I mean, you know, if it was a trial from 200 years ago when you were coming up as a kid, is a trial back in that time frame, is that like life was just that much simpler, or is it a relative thing? I mean, kids today grow up in tech, except for they still don't know it. I can promise you that. I'm just wondering, like, you know, the world around you is just vastly different and more complex now than it was forever ago.
The issues in a trial were far simpler in the day. We didn't have forensics. You know, until 50 years ago, 30 years ago, we didn't have. When you look back in the founding times, most crimes were solved by eyewitness testimony.
Okay.
Which we've largely proven to be not reliable at all. But that's
complete
how people,
bunk.
the police had to catch you in the act of doing something, or someone had to witness you in the act of doing something. And then, as society has evolved, we've learned how to connect people to things that no one saw them happen. I mean, what did the fingerprint open up in terms of prosecutions before we had fingerprint technology? Yeah. Before we had the advanced DNA, which I don't understand at all. You know, I can't tell you mitochondrial or whatever DNA from another type of DNA. But before we had DNA, a lot of cases were being resolved that nobody saw anything because there's a DNA connection and that magically seals their fate. Well, maybe it should, maybe it shouldn't.
I have a quick teeny little lesson for you. Teeny, teeny, teeny. Mitochondrial DNA, just think of the letter M. It's from mom. That means it goes all the way back to the beginning, however far back you want to take that. Mitochondrial DNA doesn't change over time. Just say.
But the simplicity of a trial, if you conducted a trial in the Abe Lincoln days, when I was born, you would have been looking at eyewitnesses for your evidence. Did you see John Wilkes Booth? What did he do? Oh, he lowered his weapon, and he did what next? Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't have been bringing in a ballistics expert to talk about that weapon. There were no ballistics experts in those days. But now all the complexity of you arguing about the credibility of the evidence and whether it was properly, if the chain of evidence was sufficient, and if the expert that the state had was qualified, and if the defense was provided ample opportunity to contest, you have to split evidence up sometimes. You know, you need blood for the defense to examine. I mean, it's a whole different world. I mean, what we do now in a trial is so far different than what we did 50, 75 years ago, much less way back in the founders' times.
The other thing that I can't remember how the expression goes, but I think it's something to the effect of, if you can't figure out how to get off of jury duty, then you're a moron or something like that. So the more affluent, the more educated, the more sophisticated people often figure out ways to get off jury duty, where maybe someone that's something, you know, maybe they don't have air conditioning, they live in the house in the South. This would be an opportunity for them to spend a few days in air conditioning all day.
Well, there's some validity to that. The jury pools that are picked are not nearly representative enough of society. I can assure you, if Buffett gets I cannot assure you that. I'm guessing that if Buffett gets a subpoena for jury duty, he would probably rather be managing billions and billions of dollars of his money rather than sitting in a jury pool, waiting to be questioned and be examined and be asked his views of things. So I would imagine that he would do everything he could to get excused, and he would be able to get excused because he's a busy man.
Yes, no doubt. Yeah, and you know, riding around on your luxury yacht, your $100 million yacht, boy, that would be tough. Sorry, I can't be bothered with this little petty theft at the base exchange for some videos.
But the complexity of trials is really what's changed in terms of the jury understanding of the issues, and jurors that are over their head. You can't take a person who doesn't understand these issues and put them in a jury box and have them magically understand. They will hear from an expert from each side, and they'll decide which expert they like.
Yes.
And they want to believe.
Back to biases.
Yes. Well, you don't magically become an expert just because you're sitting on a jury.
All right. So your opinion is we should have them or we should not?
I think that there's strong arguments to be made that our jury system needs to be reformed. Of course, it's only one component of our failed system.
Yeah, sure.
There's not enough cases going to trial. There's too many cases that are being pled out. And that's a show into itself, several shows in terms of why everything's resolved by plea. But the cases that go to trial, the people get varying degrees of justice depending on where the trial is conducted.
All right, well, how about we go over to the appeal where a night in jail for over $2.75. It looks like this guy hopped over the gate thing is at the train station. And so there you go. That gets you some time in jail. I don't know that our justice system should be like based on economics. Like, you know, you commit a crime, you should be put away. We shouldn't necessarily consider the financial side of it because you've obviously broken a law. But $2.75 seems about petty.
Well, it does, and it's one of those things where you're trying to balance as a society. If you just give a green light to everybody not to pay their subway fares,
right.
How many people will disregard, and how fair is that to everybody else? On the other hand, it's how much do you want to spend on arresting, processing a person, and after they're processed, if they make bond or don't make bond. The cost of keeping them in jail, and to what end do you want? Do you want this person for jumping the turnstile? Apparently, go ahead.
Go. Well, I mean, this just seems stupid. This just seems overwhelming to me over exercising some authority. I mean, it seems like the cop could just like detain him for a few moments, write him some kind of $25 citation, and like. Move the F on, because all the rest of that's not worth it.
Well, according to the story, they've done that. It says the number of arrests for fare evasion has fallen across all boroughs over the last few years, with Manhattan seeing the biggest decline according to its own data. New York PD's made 992 arrests citywide through the first quarter of this year. In the same period, New York police officers issued 19,000 summonses. So now a summons is far less costly because you ask someone to show up and respond to the summons. So New York PD reports making one arrest for every 46 summonses.
I know what we should do. We should put in face tracking cameras, and we should do facial recognition at the subway, and we could then just have them automatically get tickets. We don't even have to have the police in there. Just do facial recognition. Done. Problem solved.
It says that says even though advocates acknowledge that the system lost $215 million to fare evasion, they argue that it's a relatively small sum. Authority's operating budget for 2018 was $16.7 billion.
I'm just gonna guess 500,000 people. God, it's got to be more than that. There's 30 something million people in New York. So is it 5 million people ride public transit daily? It's got to be a gargantuan number.
Well, this reminds me of our lunch people who, kids in school, in Albuquerque public schools, who weren't paying for their lunches, and they were giving them, rather than allowing them to eat lunch at some point of their delinquent accounts, or were giving them providing them a brown paper bag with a sandwich. And that, of course, would be somewhat humiliating for a kid. And so we had a state senator here, Mr. Michael Padilla, passed a bill that says that you can't shame the kid for a parent refusing to pay the lunchroom bill. So here basically the argument that I'm coming around to is basically that we've said, yeah, we recognize people are not going to pay their lunchroom cafeteria bills. We're not going to make the kids suffer. So here they would be people who would take advantage of not having to pay fares. Is it worth the cost to society to go after those people aggressively and spend a lot of resources? And if you don't go after them, will the people who evade paying their fares, will it go up exponentially? Will it explode beyond all imagination? We have not seen that here in case of the legislation on the free lunches. As far as I know, the last statistics I've heard since that became law, there has not been an explosion of people saying, well, I don't have to pay lunch for my kids anymore because Padilla passed a bill that says that the kid has to be given lunch even if they have an overdue cafeteria account. I have not seen that. So I'm not sure there would be an explosion of turnstile jumpers, but that's always the fear, is what would happen next.
Yeah. Well, let me give a couple corrections. New York City has 8 million people, but the surrounding area, like the New York metropolitan area, is 13 million. And it's 2.4 million people ride weekly. That is a crazy, crazy number of people that ride public transit there. So yeah, that couple hundred, what was it? Did you say a couple hundred million dollars?
Yeah, out of a $16 billion budget.
Yeah, it does seem like to be a drop in the bucket. But I just like, so same thing, and we've been belaboring this for a while, but there are people that are very willing to go pay for a service that they could get for free if they find value in it. This podcast would be a perfect example of it. You can go download it for free. It's not restricted. We greatly appreciate the people that support us. And they do it voluntarily. And I'm thinking that you don't want to own a car in New York City. Emily Horowitz, she doesn't own a car because you can't move around that city without the public transit. So I would suspect that people would be like, heck yeah, man, I'll pay for that.
Well, I think we have to carefully analyze if we're spending our resources wisely to prosecute and chase after fair jumpers. It may not be the best use of resources to do that.
Well, alrighty then. So let's move on. The next one on the list. Oh, so this came from Yahoo, and this is kind of appalling. Convicted Florida offender CM is beaten by another inmate and drowned in a toilet. I thought one of the fundamental missions behind prison was to actually keep you safe while you're locked up. I thought, they are now in charge of pretty much everything about your life. So where is there any level of protection for people behind the walls?
Well, now I'm going to sound like a right-wing fanatic here on this one, because there are some good correctional administrators out there that try to do a good job. And it's a careful balance when you're running a correctional facility, when you take people in. You know intuitively that these charges are not the most popular. You know that if you've been in corrections for any period of time, you know that. So it's not as if this comes as a surprise to them that person would have the potential to be harmed. You also know that you've got people like me yelling at you to not put people in solitary confinement because of the damage that solitary confinement is. So you've got people like me suing you, saying that you need to let these people have some freedom and you need to let them be in general population so that they don't degrade mentally. So classification is a very, very tough job, and doing it well, those who do it well, you have to give them kudos for knowing how to figure out where inmates belong and where they don't belong, and being able to justify, because not only do you have to be good at figuring out where they belong, you need to be able to put that on paper to explain why you classified them that way and what the factors were, because you're going to have some enterprising lawyer coming after you saying that you wrongfully put that person in solitary confinement. So it's a tough situation for correctional administrators. Then you combine that with the age of the facility and the technologies they have available in the facility. The older facilities, which I know nothing about this one, but the older facilities were that you didn't have direct line of sight. It's a lot of stuff can go in a linear model that can't go in a direct supervision model in terms of how quickly things can be spotted before you can intervene. So we don't know how much technology was available to observe, how quickly help could have gotten to this person. But in the end of the day, you are responsible for trying to keep people who are confined safe. And clearly there was a failure here. I would like to pontificate. I'd like to pontificate about the people who do such a thing. You people that are in prison listen to us, which I'm sure we don't have very many. But why is it that you get so mad at society for judging you and not giving you a fair due process? And why are you so willing to be so judgmental about everyone who comes in the door? We don't know that this person got convicted properly. We don't know that this person, we don't know all the details. And you're in no position to be extracting your vigilante justice. You're sick. And you, I mean, you're totally wrong, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, so Will in chat asked about why aren't people with certain kinds of crimes segmented in the prison because a certain class is certainly targeted. You know, we've talked about the hierarchy in prison before, that our people are pretty low on the totem pole. You know, people that have actually committed murder are like actually kind of like revered, and they're high up on the food chain, so to speak. And I know that where I was, they didn't do very much segmentation at all. And Will is saying that where he was, they didn't do it either. I have heard of this, but it seems like I have a feeling it comes down to a resource issue. But why don't they take people that seem to be what would be a target? Why don't those people get their own wing of the prison, so to speak?
Well, and that's a good question, Will. And the answer is they do that. You when you do that, you have people just because you're with your own kind doesn't mean that you like your own kind. And even within the hierarchy, if you put all the people in the sex offender unit, sex offense accusations or convictions together, there are those who think, well, mine was different. Mine was, yeah, I'm a sex offender, but I did statutory rape. That's a whole different thing. I never molested a child. Well, I looked at porn. So you still have a hierarchy. And then you're assuming that prison administrators get to choose how often that people are dumped in their facilities. If you have a correctional facility that's designed for 900 and you have a population of 1,350 people, that limits your ability to move people around and place people because every ounce of space you've got is valuable. And you're overcrowded already. So what do you do with this person that comes in? When people react that way, they've never actually analyzed what it is on the administrative side. And I'm not forgiving people because we've got some horrible prison and correctional administrators out there. But we've also got some very good ones out there. It's like everything else.
Yeah, there are decent people out there.
And they do the very best they can with the limited resources. Our local jail, now that we've got our population down to about 78 to 80% of its design capacity, we have the ability to move people around because you've got some open space. And if you see trouble brewing, and if you pick up on things, you've got spare capacity to move somebody. If you're running at 112% capacity, you don't have the ability to move someone around. All you have the ability to do is to lock them down into solitary. And of course, that gets you sued because that's detrimental to their health. So I'd like to have if a prison administrator would come on here or even a local jail administrator, I'd be happy to talk to him about that because I understand enough to know that it's not an easy job classifying people and trying to prevent all harm that can happen. And this one obviously got through the cracks, and it's a tragedy and it's sad, and the people who did it should be presumed innocent, but they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and if they're convicted, appropriately punished.
Do you want to cover Scalia now real quick?
I think it's a good time to hear from Justice Scalia. I think that I wonder if I should tell people on our Scalia clips what the purpose is before or after.
Do you want to just give us a quick little intro of what this is, and then we can talk in detail about it on the other side?
Yeah, we've been running for several episodes now, a minute and a half, 2 to 3 minute clips of the late Justice Antonin Scalia, in terms of what his judicial philosophy is. We pick him because our audience tends to be more conservative, and he tends to be very colorful and charismatic. Whether you agree with him, you can't not like the way the man communicates and how he expresses himself, and he expresses himself so succinctly. And so in this particular clip, it's about, you hear me saying, well, just because you don't like something, that doesn't make it unconstitutional. So this is Scalia explaining that.
Very good. Here we go. Here is Antonin Scalia.
Why are you a faint-hearted originalist?
Oh, my, I said that a long time ago. I said in the course of I guess it was a Law Review piece that, you know, if you're an originalist paper and what the stamp says is stupid but constitutional, whack, stupid but constitutional, whack, stupid but constitutional. The notion that everything that is stupid is unconstitutional is probably the besetting sin of judges. Anyway.
I got a quick question for you. Why does everyone laugh when he gets, why did everyone give him applause when he says he's cranky?
I think it's funny. That's a little self-deprecating humor that he's got.
Yes.
There. But he, so when I say that, I just happen to run across this clip listening to show prep. I'm looking for something good from Scalia, and I ran across this, and I said, well, gee, I've said so many times, just because you don't like something doesn't make it unconstitutional. And just because something is not well-grounded in science and statistical data and empirically reviewed, they shouldn't be able to do that. That is nonsense. That's not what the judges wear the robes to do, is to determine what the best public policy is. That's what you, as a citizen and as a voter of this country, that's your job, to determine what the most efficient and best public policy is. And if you get it wrong, if you make a bad choice, our system allows those bad choices to be corrected. If we enact a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit and we see that traffic fatalities go up and commerce slows down and all these things happen that we didn't anticipate, of course, we should be able to anticipate that because we've tried that before. But we are able to go back and change the policy. That's what democracy is all about. You shouldn't cower down and say, well, we made a mistake. Judges, will you save us from our own stupidity? So that I thought that was fitting for making the comparison so people understand. When we get it wrong in public policy arena, we go back and fix it through the same process that where we made the mistake to begin with. We convince our citizens, we convince our fellow citizens, we convince our lawmakers, and we put pressure on them till we get the policies that we want.
Where does the line get crossed between a law being just, one that doesn't enter the realm of something being constitutional or not? And I hope that do all laws fall into that category? And then the next extension is, when do we fall into the category of a law being unconstitutional?
Well, when you can, that's easy, when you can cite what aspect of the Constitution it violates.
So literally, when you read the words and the text and then the amendments and all that stuff, that is, but so, you know, talking about like speed limits, there's nothing said anywhere in there about speed limits. So wouldn't those laws just be unconstitutional because nothing is spoken about it?
Just the opposite. The Constitution prohibits what we can't do, by and large, where we can't go. The Constitution as a document protects us. We're not protected and allowed to go out. The Constitution doesn't protect us and allow us to go out and drive recklessly and endanger our fellow citizens. So, of course, you can have laws regarding speed limits.
And they don't enter into the realm of constitutional or not?
Not unless you did something in the speed limit law. And I think I've used this example before. If you passed a speed limit law and you said men can drive 75 and women can drive 55,
okay,
then you've got an equal protection. That is a constitutional issue there.
But the speed limit itself is not the problem. Different rules for different people is.
Yes, you have to be able to cite everything is presumed constitutional upon its enactment. And the challenging party bears the burden to show by the clearest of evidence it is not. And a judge not liking it doesn't make it unconstitutional. Now, unfortunately, we have things where judges don't like it, and they do let their personal views come in. But that is not sufficient. Under our separation of powers, not liking something is not sufficient grounds to strike it down. And that's where Scalia and the textualist come from, is that, yeah, I don't know that I would do this. If I were serving the legislature, I probably wouldn't. But I'm not serving the legislature. I'm looking at whether or not there's a constitutional infraction, and I don't see it here. So Therefore, it's upheld.
Interesting. Anything more about Scalia, Larry?
No, I think that illustrates my point of what I was trying to make, is that stupid but constitutional. So just because you don't like something and just because you don't think it adds up with all the data that you'd like to see supporting it, that doesn't matter.
Maybe I could get one some of our like musically inclined listeners to give us like an intro, almost like a Mr. Rogers thing, to introduce the Scalia clip and then have an outro on the other side. So you could come in and you could put on your sweater, you could change your shoes out, and then on your way back out, you change back out. Oh, you do remember Mr. Rogers, right?
I do. I like my colonial, I like my colonial music, but we didn't play it this week.
I didn't do that this week.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, we're going to move on to one of my favorite subjects. This is like, you know, people pick their little pet peeve issues. This is one of my, I think, like this and the restrictions, the living and work restrictions. These are probably my two biggest things about lie detector tests. This one, this is from the Smithsonian.com, and it's a pretty well-sourced and cited read, going back to where Gary Powers, the guy that flew the U-2 spy plane over Russia and got bombed down. And at the beginning of the thing, I want to read a little part of this. It says, I'm just going to paraphrase it, but he said, like, hey, I will take this thing. But after he was done, he's like, he did this for like his entry into the CIA. He opted to take one. But when he was done, he was like, this is the biggest garbage. It's stressful. It doesn't do anything. It's fake. And he wasn't ever going to do it again. But it turns out that when he got into Russia, they probably did the same thing to him again. But all this smoke and mirrors and stuff about the way the polygraph is, it's just complete hogwash. It drives me crazy. It's pseudoscience. There's no evidence behind it. And then after 9/11, like, it gained a whole lot more popularity because we have potentially people in the United States that are not loyal to us. So we need to vet them, and we're going to use this kabuki machine to vet them. So that's my rant about polygraphs.
Well, you know, that's the thing where we as a society, we have taken action decades ago. I think it was back during the Reagan administration that Congress passed restrictions on employers using polygraphs. And the pre-employment polygraphs were largely a thing of the past, except for in federal service. But if you went to your local Magic Market back in those days, or nobody knows Magic Market unless you're from Georgia, but you went to your local 7-Eleven, and applied for a job, before you could get a job with the local 7-Eleven or many other private employers back prior to that legislation, you had to undergo a pre-employment polygraph test.
For 7-Eleven?
Yes.
But
the reason why I know, because I had to take one when I worked for Magic Market. Who?
What in the world?
My Circle K.
What are you sharing state secrets about how to do food distribution?
Well, no. When you worked in those days, as convenience stores were by and large far smaller than they are today, you had a lot of convenience store clerks who worked alone. And the theory went, and you have to look at the technology we had in the day. We didn't have the ability to watch a store clerk like we do now.
Yeah, sure.
In 1974 and 75. So you had a person working in a store all alone, having a customer flow through every 5, 10, 15 minutes with no way to be monitored. You know, you didn't have point of sale systems that were online. You didn't have monitoring that was live in terms of visual. So in order to give that person that high level of trust that they could be in a store and have hundreds of dollars sales that were rang up for gasoline and money orders and stuff, that they had to have a little bit of integrity. So they would have you do a polygraph test to find out if you've ever stolen anything from any employer you've worked for. And that would be one of the questions. Have you ever taken anything of value? And you would go through the pretest interview, and they would ask you, now, we understand grazing, as it was called. We understand you that if you've worked in this business before, you've poured yourself a cup of coffee, or you've done grazing. We're not worried about that. But have you taken anything of value other than employee grazing? And if you had any trouble on those polygraph tests, you didn't get hired.
That is horrifying to me that that's what you would do.
Well, I went, that I is went horrifying. That. I went through that to get a job in the magic market, as I was saying, and somehow or another I miraculously passed, or else they let it go through that with my failing. But
or the test is complete bullshit, and it didn't matter because I mean, you know, you just came through whether you lied or not. The test results said that it was okay.
Well, and then they would do another round of polygraphs when the inventory came up short, because those stores are susceptible to theft. If I'm thinking about it, when nothing's been monitored, things walk away. So then on a monthly basis, I believe it was, they would take inventory of the store, and if it came up beyond the margin of tolerance, they would polygraph all the employees, and they would ask you, had you taken anything of value that you hadn't paid for, or had you allowed anything of value to be taken from the store? Are you aware of anything that would cause the store to have a loss of inventory of company property? You went through the equivalent of a maintenance polygraph if your store came up short.
Right. And just to take a quick trip down memory lane, if I'm not mistaken, it was episode 2 that we talked about polygraphs, you know, very early in our podcasting career. And leading up to it, I recall it being a little bit heated because you were like, no, man, these things work. And I was like, no, man, they're complete bullshit. And then, you know, you are one of the few people that's able to go, well, maybe I was wrong. But I'm still kind of shocked that when we had that conversation, you were like, no, man, we use them all the time. What's wrong with them? And I was like,
Well, I still say the similar thing. Everyone that we have given a polygraph to in the practice of law, and we have told them you show deception. Now, that's what the result has been. They've confessed. So whether the polygraph was worth a damn or not didn't matter. The person admitted that the allegation was true.
Yes.
And so that's what now we've had a few that were the polygraph proved inconclusive, and we tell them we don't know any more than what we did after before this test was administered, because the polygrapher was not able to give us an opinion of whether you were truthful or deceptive. But when the polygrapher was giving us the opinion that they were deceptive, I don't recall a case where the person didn't fess up. So what do you have to explain that? Whether it's kabuki science or whatnot, it got the information that we were looking for, which is why they keep doing this, because it yields the information. People say, oh, well, yes. I guess I broke my curfew. Oh, well, I guess I was looking at porn or whatever. So,
the answer is, it's called placebo. If a doctor walks in and he's wearing his golf outfit, you are not going to feel as relieved than if he walks in wearing the white coat and the stethoscope and all that shit. So it's a complete placebo effect, and you believe the machine does something, so therefore you prove them that the machine shows something, but it technically doesn't. It's the equivalent of acupuncture, chiropractic care. It's the equivalent of all of these things, gay conversion therapy. They're all bullshit.
So now we just lost 300 podcast supporters the chiropractic. There are people out there who tell me emphatically that they could not get out of bed for the last 6 months straight. And that they were almost ready to end their life until they started having acupuncture. And then they're boxing and they're doing marathons, and they never believed that they'd be so healthy again. So I've heard that throughout my life.
I have heard as well. I'm just, you know, it's kabuki. And these people go to like a 2-year certificate program and they get called doctor. Just saying.
So, well, how is it if you truly were flat on your back for the last 3 months and couldn't stand the pain? What magically makes that pain go away? Because I know when I have pain and I can't move and I can barely bend over, it doesn't. If the person can't have they don't have mobility, and all of a sudden they do. What caused that mobility to have? If it wasn't the acupuncture, what did do it?
Someone cracking your back may make some pain go away, but the philosophy, the theory behind it. Just to take a quick little detour. The organization that is regulating the chiropractors are the chiropractors themselves. They are self-lobbying to get themselves into more treatment, to more health insurance programs without any sort of like empirical, any sort of scientific evidence to support their claims. It's along the lines of homeopathy. So I'm not saying that cracking, because you know, you crack your knuckle, you're like, wow, that feels so much better. You crack your neck, maybe that feels better. But Their philosophy that you crack this and it cures cancer, that is more along the lines of what I'm referring to.
Well, I was
because there are those that talk about that.
The acupuncturist, I don't understand it, but people have sworn to me that has made their life so quality of life so much better, and that has relieved chronic pain. And I'm all for relief of chronic pain, whatever.
Sure.
If you smoke some of that wacky weed, whatever it does to relieve chronic pain. But people tell me that their life is dramatically better after having those type treatments. So what is the explanation? If the needles didn't do it, what did?
Placebo. You think it does, so therefore it does. In the case of acupuncture, it's almost the same thing as like the sex offender stuff. There's no evidence that says residency restrictions or work restrictions reduces recidivism. Yet we still do it. So on that same token, there's no evidence to support all of these pseudoscience kind of things, yet we still do it because we believe it works. It's the same thing. So there you go. And yes, alrighty. I'm sorry. Thank you, 300 listeners. It was nice to have you around. Talk to you later. Well, Larry, this one's all you.
Wait till you see our ratings now.
I know, right? I know. They're all going to listen to it. And then next, episode 88 will be like zero. This one comes from the Marshall Project, and you're going to get to drive the bus. And it's one lawyer, 5 years, 3,802 cases. That's crazy.
That's something we've talked about. I don't know if we're going to spend gobs of time, but it exemplifies the failed system we have, and you can't possibly handle these type of caseloads. So obviously everybody's being pled guilty because that's all you could do. I think this is out of Detroit, right? Yeah, this was in Detroit.
Yeah, it's totally Detroit.
But in theory, everybody has the right to an attorney. But you look at this fee schedule: full day trial, $180, plea, $110. Now tell me which you can do more pleas in a day than you can do full day trials if you're going to get $180. And it's just sad because the defense, we don't get to control the flow of cases. We're on the receiving end of the.
Wait a minute. So an attorney for defending someone in the public defender's office would get $180 a day? 15 years ago, I made more than that per day as an IT worker.
That's the sad. We hear these stories about $40 per hour. I think in Wisconsin, we've talked about that, and we've talked about in Louisiana where the crushing caseload. I mean, you don't have to look far. It's systemic and across the board. Even in my state, it's bad. But
that's crazy low.
But my point is we're of the tripod. You've got the defense, the prosecution, and the judge. Of the tripod, two legs of that tripod can control caseload. We can't. We don't file cases on the defense side. Your defense attorney will never file a case against you. So we don't get to be the initiator, nor do we get to referee when the rules are being followed. And when the rules are not being followed and timelines are not being met, the court can dismiss cases. And the courts are very hesitant to do that because then they get slammed like they did in the last, what was it, episode or two episodes back where the judge did get slammed for this very reason, but for not waiving the kid up to adult court in New Jersey. So we're the only leg of the stool that has no control over the flow of cases. The only thing we can do on the defense side to make a case go away is to do what?
Plead it out.
That's the only thing we can do. We can't dismiss it. We can't amend the charges. We can't not file the case. The only thing we can do is to plead it out. So if the cases keep coming, what do we do? Well, I think
it's a pressure release valve.
I have some radical ideas, and at some point I'm going to have Ashley back, and I'm going to ask her this question about why would it not be good for a defense attorney when the judge calls the case and says, "State the counselor, state your appearance," and the counselor state their appearance. Are we ready? Ready on behalf of the state defense? No, Your Honor, not ready. You're what? I'm not ready, Your Honor. You're not ready to proceed? Well, this has been on the calendar for 2.5 months now. This has been a trial setting. But, Your Honor, I'm not ready. Well, why aren't you ready? Well, I have not been able, with my 117 other cases that I have not been able to do a proper investigation. I haven't been able to review the discovery. I've got 2,600 pages, and they're expecting Epstein to have 1 million pages of discovery, they're saying. But I've got 2,600 pages of discovery. I haven't interviewed a single witness because I've got your trial setting, I've got seven others I've had that were sent for trial in the last month, and I wasn't ready for those either because the caseload is just unbearable. So I'd like to state for the record that the defense is not ready. Now, I know that's very radical, but at some point, if the lawyers declare that they're not ready, the judge can't force them. Well, they can because they can do whatever they want to do until they're stopped. But a judge shouldn't force a trial when the person's stating for the record why they're not ready and the steps that would be pertinent to that person's defense that they have not been able to complete. To me, it sounds like that's the next thing that you can do to try to bring attention to the situation and say, I'm not ready because it's just not possible for me to get ready. So I'm not ready. So we're going to ask what would happen if you did that? Would all life as we know it end?
Probably. You've been an employer for multiple years. How many working days are there in a year?
Well, I guess
I don't need to put you on the spot.
A week times 50, you'd get about 250. You'd get about 250 days, a couple of weeks of
okay,
vacation,
good.
And then you have holidays. So you're going to be somewhere in the 200 plus days per year.
That's totally what I thought it was. I think it's 200 days. Well, Google says there's 261. 180 times 200 is $36,000 a year. Someone that goes through all of the torture and pain and sacrifice of going to law school to come out. Not everything is all about the money, but to make 36 grand, that sounds really shabby.
Oh, well, that's assuming you could do a trial every day. You can't do it.
Correct.
Yeah. You can't be prepared for a trial every day.
Yeah. So there would be other partial things. Yeah. So, I mean, like that would be, you could live on 36 depending on where you live, but that's not a lot of money to live on. There's not a lot left over for you to do much.
It's physically impossible that you couldn't do a trial every day.
Right. There is that. This is crazy.
You could not be ready for a trial every day because there's a lot of prep work in doing a trial.
Sure.
It's people actually like to see their attorneys. Their attorneys are supposed to, people are supposed to, people love to see their attorney. Their attorney is supposed to compare the criminal complaint with the statute to see if the elements of the statute that are required to be proven can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There might be a need to pull some case law related to that statute to see if there's been any favorable developments in terms of what would help the defense. So you've got that aspect of it. Then if you're convinced that they properly charged the person, then you've got to look at the evidence that they put forward. That's called discovery. So you've got to look at the box of evidence that the prosecution has turned over to you. Or if they have an open file policy, you have to go down to the DA's office and look at the file and see what they've got in it, make copies. And then, depending on who's surfacing as witnesses, you probably need to do a little bit of background check on the witnesses and maybe have a conversation with them to see if there's any conflict between what they said in their statement and what they're going to say at trial. I mean, there's just a whole lot. You couldn't be ready for a trial every day. So you wouldn't get your $180 every day because you couldn't do a trial on each day.
And so let me put on my counterpoint hat. Well, you should have thought about that before you committed your crime. You should have thought about having more resources and saving up. If you knew you were going to be doing criminal activity, then you should have saved up so you get a proper representation. What else could we come up with? If you can't do the time, don't do the crime?
Yeah, that's what they would say. That's such kabuki. I mean, we have. Why don't we tell people who make poor choices in their life and other areas, why don't we tell them too bad, so sad?
Absolutely.
We treat people who have made very poor choices, particularly health choices that people make.
No doubt.
We don't say too bad you did that. But
do we? But we don't do that with people that end up with lung cancer. I mean, it's pretty widely known that if you smoke, you get but if you get lung cancer, you are probably a smoker. So we don't say too bad, so sad on those people, do we?
All the obesity related elements.
True.
We don't tell people that. But the system is not going to self-correct. It's going to require a lot of changing public attitudes to get the resources for the defense side. And let me give a little due credit. I was listening to a radio talk show yesterday, Friday morning on KKOB AM here. And they're talking about criminal justice reform. And the reforms committee is co-chaired by a Republican and a Democrat. And Sandra Rue, the Republican, said that it's important to adequately fund defense because the system breaks down without that. Now, he's pro-prosecution and he wants people to be held accountable. But he says the system can't work without that. Now, that's a monumental admission for a conservative Well, he's more moderate, but for coming from that side of the aisle to say we have to fund defense. So I'm giving kudos, but he's just one. We have to have people come around to recognizing that if we're going to make everything illegal in the United States and we want to be law and order and we want to prosecute everybody, that there's a cost. Due process costs money.
And no doubt.
Maybe we've got to decide we should put fewer people into the system because we do have choices about who we bring criminal charges against. But unfortunately, those choices are not made by the defense.
We should enact policies, Larry, like especially where you work, that any money that you take in, you are going to be the oversight committee to make sure that you are not doing anything inappropriate with those funds. This next article comes from law.com, the New York Law Journal. New York District Attorneys formally moved to strike down prosecutorial watchdog law. So this is a law to help the people that are being watched make sure that they're doing their job with integrity, but they don't want to be watched.
I don't see a problem with that. Why should the police or the prosecutors be watched? They know what to do.
It seems like it's a conflict of interest to me. Feels like it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I threw heads in here, and actually, it doesn't open completely for me. But I think it's one of those things where the people through their legislative process recognize this need to be done. That oversight was not sufficient, and they won. Now the prosecutors are trying to use the courts to strike down the people's enactment. Now, I suppose that's the right to do that, but they should be held the same standard of proof that they have to show by the clearest of proof that the people's enactment is unconstitutional.
This is the same that we talk about where the, even like the body cameras. So this would be hard to, I shouldn't say that now, we have doctored videos all over the place, but if a cop is wearing a body camera, I'm going to make the assumption that it's not doctored video. It gives you an unbiased perspective of, instead of having the cop write down his words, it gives you somebody that's sort of impartial so you can watch what happened. Why shouldn't we have other government entities be oversighted? Is that a word?
I don't understand why that anyone who has an employer gets to self-oversee. Try that in your normal course of work. Tell your employer when you clock in at the grocery store, tell them that you get to decide the type of cash registers that are used, the type of surveillance that's used in the store, the type of point of sale systems that are used to process transactions. Did you get to decide the detention policy of who you can frisk and who you can hold? And try telling your employer that. And find out what happens to you. You get to decide what. It's just nonsensical to think that we employ the police and we employ the district attorneys and we don't get to oversee them. Really? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. So,
we should move over to this article from The Appeal, which would be the second appeal article tonight. And this is, it's time to allow people with felony convictions to serve on juries. One thing that I see out of this is with there's a really high number of people in the United States that have been convicted of a crime that would then offset the quote unquote, the burden of the people that haven't committed a crime to serve on more jury panels. And I guess, you know, way back in the day where there were far fewer laws and fewer people convicted of things that would disenfranchise them from voting, then, you know, maybe 1 out of 100, whatever that number is, it wouldn't make that much of a difference in the grand scheme of things. But now with so many people that haven't had been touched by the criminal justice system, you have a lot of people that don't get to have a say in how the juries go.
Well, that's what the article says, estimated 20 million people. It's funny, we don't know precisely, but approximately 8% of adults, and it's a third of black men have felony convictions. But it's beyond my imagination that at some point in a forgiving country, as we profess to be, that you never get to be fully redeemed. And it's the same thing with owning a weapon. You never get to this precious right of self-defense. You never are allowed to defend yourself again. You're never allowed in some states to vote again. You're never allowed to serve on a jury. And yet we're a forgiving nation, really?
So, isn't there something to be said, though, depending on what the law is? I don't want to try and go down this slippery slope of, hey, this crime is worse than this. But at a time when only the most heinous of things were, you wouldn't want that mindset to then be on the jury to then cloud that, muddy those waters. But now you like almost get arrested. Like, you know, that kid, he like resisted arrest that we talked about last week. He got his face slammed in. I don't know that he was convicted of anything, but you have that kind of interaction with the police that could prevent you from serving on a jury. It's ridiculous.
Well, this appeal article highlights the Senate Bill 310, which would restore the right to serve on a jury. California's Senate Bill 310 would restore the right to serve on a jury. New York and Louisiana bills failed to pass this year, attempting to do a similar thing. But I think that after a period of time, maybe it's not the day you finish your sentence. I don't know what the magic time is, but why is it that you're forever, forever tarnished, that you can't fully participate in society, but yet we're a forgiving country?
I think I've spoken about me serving on two jury panels before, and I found it to be one of the most fascinating things that I've ever sat through, was to actually like watch the jousting between the two sides and hearing the testimony and trying at my very best to be, you know, impartial and taking it all in. And I was just intrigued by the process, the robe, the pomp and circumstance of the formalities and all that stuff, you know, all rise, all that garbage. I just thought it was neat.
Were you on a civil jury or a criminal jury?
A criminal for both.
So,
and one was ridiculous. This woman shoplifted three videos from the Air Force Base exchange up the way. And because she did it on federal property, it was a federal prosecution, which was insane. $60 a video, and now she's got federal charges. And she totally was going to lose, because like the jury was like, she totally put those in the shopping cart. She totally put her shopping bag on top of it. She totally attempted to hide it so that she could go through the checkout process and then walk out, and that's where they stopped her. It's just ridiculous.
Jury found her guilty.
Yes. And I believe on that one, I was the foreman or whatever the hell they call it, the person in charge of the jury panel. So I got to read. I was like, Your Honor, we find the defendant guilty.
Why didn't you so nullify? You as a jury, you can nullify if you find that the runaway juries do that on a semi-regular basis.
I totally, like watching the video of the woman, it was to me, it felt completely obvious what she was doing. I mean, she was totally trying to lift the videos out of the store. So, I mean, to me, it felt like she was intending to deceive and get out of there and shoplift.
Well, I feel the same way about, I'm not a big weapons proponent, but I believe that if we're going to be a country with hundreds of millions of weapons, that at some point, if that is such a precious right, that after you've had the service of your sentence in its totality, that there would be a point where that precious right ought to come back to you. If it's that precious, why did you lose it? There are a lot of felonies that have nothing to do. Martha Stewart didn't do anything with a weapon. She's not allowed to own one anymore. She's a convicted felon.
Yeah.
So she can't protect herself any longer. So if that right is so cherished and so precious, when will you forgive Martha Stewart for her transgression and allow her to be a full participant in society? She would probably be a pretty good person to sit on a jury if now that she's been through what she's gone through.
Yeah, she could be a pretty good advocate for us.
So, I think she could be a very fair and impartial juror because she understands what it's like to be put in a position where the deck is stacked against you, and holding the prosecution to their standard of proof is kind of what we're supposed to do when you're sitting in that jury box. I've never been seated. I've only been summoned and then disqualified, but that's kind of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go into that jury box skeptical.
Right. Yes. And you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. So you're supposed to wait until you see the evidence. You're supposed to wait until you've heard the testimony. You've waited till you've deliberated with your cohorts in the private room back there for you to then say guilty. It's supposed to be challenging, and it's supposed to be an uphill battle for you to get that guilty verdict.
Correct.
All right. Well, then New York Times, this one, dude, this one really kind of, I don't know. I don't even know how to take this one. It says, abuse victims, three billboards called for stronger laws. Then the state showed up. This woman was apparently a victim of some sort of sexual assault. And then she rents a couple, three billboards, it looks like. And there's a picture of her in the middle. It's very stark. And I can't think of like the right word. It's like a grainy kind of picture. But it says, my rapist is protected by New York state law. I am not. But this introduced a whole slew of problems of it being registered as a lobbyist. I don't get it.
Well, apparently the authorities feel like what she's doing is lobbying. I don't know that I agree, but that's what our courts will resolve at some point. This is an example of evolving society where laws, when you write legislation 27 years ago about what a lobbyist is, and then we have ways to affect public policy that didn't exist 27 years ago or whatever. I don't know when these laws, maybe they're older than that, but this is an example of evolving society. So I guess the courts will have to interpret whether or not this constitutes lobbying.
And Brenda in chat says she was in fact pushing a new law. So yeah, isn't that lobbying? So if you like, when do you cross the line of just being an advocate, trying to talk to your politician and be an advocate for law change? Where do you cross the line of being a lobbyist?
We'll have to wait and see how this plays out. But
I heard some conversations with my cohorts here in Georgia that if you spend like a third of your time trying to do law changing things, that counts you as a lobbyist. Does that sound like a right ratio?
I've never heard that one before.
I can't remember if a guy here in Georgia told me that or not, but I think it was some, if the organization spends X amount of time doing that, then you should register as a 503c4, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, if you're going out there saying I'm representing NARSOL, I'm representing, but if you just show up as an individual, I don't think it ever counts. But if you walk in there saying I represent a thing, an entity, then that changes the equation.
Well, it wasn't just because she walked in, though. It's because of the extraneous activities that she did in addition to walking in. She spent $14,000 on three billboards, plus $2,000 on a website. Well, 34 years ago, when we had billboards 30 years ago, but we didn't have websites very many of them that many years ago. So the lobbying stuff wouldn't have covered that because it didn't exist. So I guess we're going to have to wait and find out what all is included in New York's lobbying guidelines.
Well, we had this conversation in the last week or so. We were talking about, hey, you know, back in the day, you would just call your local phone carrier, AT&T or whatever, and you would get a Yellow Pages ad. And whether you got just your name listed for having a phone number, or you ran a quarter, an eighth, or, you know, a whole page ad, whatever, that is how you marketed. So her having a website would be the modern day equivalent of having a flyer sent around and all that stuff. Interesting.
Well, it's. I think it's, to me, just shows example of laws not keeping pace with the evolution of society.
All right,
technology moves very rapidly, and if you look at your laws, you'll find out that most of them are way behind.
Definitely, I'm intrigued by that conversation because until, I don't know, the mid '80s or so, you know, when the computer revolution really started to take hold, I don't know that anything has changed in our history as rapidly as that, at least not for a consistent length of time. You might have had employment, not employment, but like work safety things when the Industrial Revolution came around, but you had kids riding farm equipment that was incredibly unsafe 100 years ago and 200 years ago with steam-powered whatever medoohickeys. You probably remember those days. But the pace at which the internet changes things is breathtaking. And I don't see how you get the 80-year-old senators that are up there to have any clue as to how to apply laws. It takes them so long to debate it, to hear it. And then by then it's completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter anymore. It's gone.
Correct. The complexity of what we're trying to deal with here is significant. And then most of these legislative bodies are part-time with a few exceptions of a handful of states, but most of them are running only 30, 60, 90 day.
The thing coming down the pike now where they're wanting to make backdoors into encryption is frightening. You can't break. They want to put backdoors into, you know, you guys use some sort of encrypted messaging technology between you and your boss. I use various ones to communicate with people. They are trying to like legislate backdoors so that they have a key to get into them. Think back a couple years, 3 years ago to the San Bernardino shooting. In California, you know, terrorists shot up the town, but they were like the brown people with turbans on their head, and they wanted to get into the people's iPhone. And there was some significant pushing by the FBI to try and get into these phones so that they could get the information. And there's a whole other backstory that goes along with that we could go into at some other time. But our federal government is, like William Barr, is trying to push to get legislation that would create backdoors. Like, you could not get software in the United States legally that allowed you to send impenetrable encrypted messages between you and your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your boss, just your friend down the street. Like, they want to make it impossible. The challenge go ahead.
If you weren't up to no good, you wouldn't be wanting to do it, because the government is not going to want to take the time to know what you're doing unless it's up to no good. I don't know why you people are so mistrusting of anything to do with police, law enforcement, or the government.
Yep. And the math is far more complicated than any of us are ever going to understand. But 2 + 2 = 4, always. And you can't make it not 4 and still be 4. And for them to put in a back door, if they know what the password is, if the feds have a way to get in, then someone else has a way to get in. And you can't have it both ways. It doesn't care who is the good guy or the bad guy. So that's my second rant for the night. I'm done.
Lost the remaining listeners.
Our last article.
This one, Brenda needs to unmute herself because she's going to explain it to us.
She's going to explain it. I have a feeling that she's going to decline to do this. But this one's from Forbes. And this one is hot off the press. Today is the 3rd, and this came out on the 3rd. And it says, is unreasonable cajoling sexual assault? And I think I didn't see what the age is, but if you are flirting, if you are saying like, hey, come on, or if you're whistling, where does it cross the line between being flirty and then where do you cross over the line and to be creepy?
That's going to be a really tough one because we're asking people not to be human anymore. What behaviors evolved in throughout eternity in terms of the pursuit and the chase and the flattery and the compliments and whatever. I didn't read the article. It kind of irritated me after I got partway through it, so I stopped.
What are you supposed to do in our society? So you fancy someone, do you hire an intermediate to try and go out and present that you are interested in courting this person? Or, can you wink at someone? I'm probably dating myself even with that, but can you say, hey, what's up? Do you want to go Netflix and chill? Like, where do you move that line from being flirty and presenting someone that you're interested? But to the other side of that, if someone says no, stop. There is that side of it. Brenda says it has to be persistent.
If they communicate with you via text or social media, and at some point, clearly the interest isn't there. I don't know how people court these days, but there's my point is that you don't know what to do if you can't tell someone they look nice anymore. You can't tell them, that's a nice outfit. I don't know how what we're supposed to do. People are going to be attracted to each other. I hate to burst your bubble. They're going to be working at Wendy's at the drive-thru and they're going to see somebody that's hot and they're going to, what do you want? Do you want asexuals?
Well, there was I don't know. I don't think we brought this up on the podcast, but there was this is months ago, but there was this is so funny too. A mom goes to visit her kid at college and the girls are running around with these like workout pants that like leave nothing to the imagination. And she sees her son looking at them and she's like all up in arms about that the girl shouldn't be doing this. And he should be ashamed of himself for looking. And I'm like, what in the world is wrong with you? If he is quote unquote red blooded male and he sees hot female, and I'm not trying to pick on genders here, pick whatever flavor you want in there. You shouldn't touch. I mean, that doesn't mean you should whistle. You shouldn't I don't know, but good grief, man. If they're going to, that's very sexist. If people are going to go out in public and dress in a way that is appealing, like enjoy. I don't know. I really struggle with that.
Well, I am struggling with it. I think that creepy behavior is not illegal behavior.
And is it unconstitutional?
Creepy behavior is not unconstitutional, nor is it illegal, and nor should it be. creepy behaviors modified by social and societal pressure and pushback. Hey, you know, demand, you can't be, this is not a meat rack here. You don't be hitting, you can't be hitting on our customers that are coming through the drive-thru, but it's still going to happen.
Well, I probably ran off all the other listeners.
Well, you probably, I guess we didn't want to have this podcast anyway, did we?
That's all I got, Larry. What else? How do people find the podcast so we can help, so we can grow?
Well, if they're listening to this, they've already found us.
Oh, that, I guess that's true. All right. Can we get our listeners to help us share and get more listeners?
That's a good question.
Where would they go to do that?
I don't know. My screen went blank.
Registrymatters.co. Come on. You can't remember this? And we are also on Twitter. You can follow Registry Matters on Twitter. Will, so you should follow us immediately since you're on Twitter. You definitely know the phone number, don't you?
I should be able to dig out the phone number from my memory. That would be 747-227-4477. Or you can send an email to us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And outstanding. You got this stuff memorized already.
Somebody needs to call us. We haven't had any phone calls to play for a while.
We haven't. We keep doing Scalia so that crowds out the phone calls.
Can just continue Scalia if people are tired of him.
And what about supporting the podcast, Larry? How would people support us the most bestest way?
Oh, that would be easy. Just go to your last paycheck advice and look at what it says. Either gross or net, either one is sufficient.
Sufficient. Excellent.
You go to patreon.com/registrymatters and you plug in one of those numbers.
Very good. That's all I got, Larry. I hope you have a super duper awesome, splendid weekend. Thank you everybody for hanging out in chat. And I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.